Morning, Sarah. Okay, so we're ahead in lab from where I want to be. And that's because with all these darn virtual labs, all we get to do is do all the talking component, and we don't get to do all of the lab work component, which is what takes so long. So we're kind of clicking through things. And we've got 2 weeks left, and I have one lab left to show you guys. And so what I thought I would do today is, rather than do a lab, is do a couple of things. Is to take a look at a synthesis that we wouldn't normally get to look at, and sort of outline maybe a little bit what special projects kind of look like, maybe talk about that a little bit, and then also just sort of open it up and use it more as office hours for things from lecture and things. But I wanted to go through and look at this molecule that I've got on the screen and talk about the synthesis of this molecule. So this is remdesivir, and you guys have probably heard that name already in the news. And I don't get to like ask anybody any questions. I always get stymied by this, so I just get to talk. So remdesivir is the first drug that they have found that has any activity against the coronavirus, and seems to help patients in their outcomes that have severe coronavirus, that have severe COVID-19. And it seems to shorten the severity of the virus, and shortens the number of days that people are really sick. So that's kind of exciting that they have the first therapeutic. And from there, once we find one therapeutic and we look at its mode of action, then we can start designing around this drug to find other drugs that can help as well. But what's cool about this is it sort of ties into a lot of things that we've been talking about in lecture. And so I wanted to spend a little bit of time looking at it and actually going over the synthesis. And I thought that we could actually do the synthesis of this molecule this morning, which is kind of cool. So to look at it, there's a couple of things that we can note. Number one, you can see all the different stereocenters that are in this molecule. And that this molecule is made, is made single isomer. So when it's synthesized, it needs to be synthesized in a single isomer given all those six different stereocenters. And remember that when a molecule has however many stereocenters it's got, if we look at 2 to the n, where n is the number of stereocenters, that's the number of isomers that can be created. And I don't know what 2 to the 6th is, but that's a really big number. What do we got? 2 times 2 is 4 times 2 is 8. Times 2 is 16. Times 2 is 32. 64. Are we up at 64 different isomers? I think is where we're at. And out of those 64 different isomers, they need to get to one. They need to make just the one isomer. And so, looking at that too is really cool, is that phosphorus is actually one of the stereocenters. And so it's not just that carbon can be a stereocenter, that we also have other elements that can be stereocenters as well. So phosphorus can also be a stereocenter, and that needs to be made in a stereoselective manner. So that's an interesting component of this molecule. And then the question is, how do you actually make something this big? So when we want to make a molecule like this, we need to find ways to be able to break the molecule down and to build it back up again. And so there's some natural places where we look to think about breaking the molecule down. For instance, if we take a look at the piece that is here, so let me just highlight this. I'm going to catch more than I want there. Let me try one more time. I just want the oxygen. I want these two bonds. This piece is a sugar. And so that's a sugar molecule that is sitting there. And so that's easy to obtain. The alcohol that is sitting over here, that is from phenol. So this is a phenol component. That's easy to obtain. So we can look at that phenol. This guy here, let's take the oxygen with it. This is L-alanine. Let's make that in green. And then the phosphorus is easy enough. That comes from phosphoric acid. So a phosphoric acid derivative is also a component of this. So this component here could be styled. I'm running out of colors. Let's make that color. And then we have a cyano group and a ring that is a tetrazole ring. I can't remember exactly what this thing is called, but we've got this ring that is here too, that is this big amine ring. And that thing can be made separately. And so we have some natural breakpoints when we look at this in some ways that that we can put this molecule back together. And these breakpoints, what we do is we look at what are called bond disconnects. So we look at the different places that we can disconnect that naturally show up because of all of these different functional groups that are in here. And so each one of these bond disconnects is a place where we look to chunk the molecule. In order to do retrosynthesis, in order to work backwards. And normally what we do is that we take a molecule like this that we would like to design, that we would like to synthesize, and we work backwards from the molecule, figuring out how we are going to tear this thing apart and put it all back together. And so we've got the main bond disconnects that we want to do, but then the question is, well, how do we actually put it back together? And so the components that are coming out of this that we're looking at is we've got an alcohol. That is that alcohol. We've got the alanine, which is L-alanine. We've got a phosphoric acid derivative. So we've got to figure out how to derivatize the phosphoric acid and get it back together. We've got the phenol. And the sugar component. And then this bond out here is undefined. That one would define later. And then we've got the amine component. And this is the one that I always have trouble drawing, because I got to get the nitrogens stuck in there. Okay, I think I got it. And so all of these pieces, all of these components need to be added back together. And that is a strategy that when we do the retrosynthesis, and we generally talk about retrosynthesis in a smaller molecule, and I'm not going to do the full retrosynthesis, I'm just going to do the forward synthesis of this molecule, that generally when we do the retrosynthesis, we break it down piece by piece of what we're going to put together first, second, third, in a backwards sort of way. And we also have to do what's called sequencing, where we look at what needs to be done first, second, third, fourth, fifth, also in terms of protecting groups of certain bonds. When we want to put certain bonds together, there are so many functional groups in this molecule that we couldn't just do reaction after reaction. We have to protect certain functional groups so that they won't be reactive during a given reaction. And then we have to remove those protecting groups. So there's more steps than what you might think, because we have to put protecting groups on and take protecting groups off in order to synthesize this. And I think it's just an interesting concept that if they're going to scale up the synthesis of this molecule in order to provide it, not just to the United States, but to provide it to the world, how much time and effort is that going to take to actually synthesize this? And what do these steps look like? And how's that actually done? So that's what I was going to kind of look at today. So are you guys on board with me? Is this sounding like a worthwhile thing to talk about for a few minutes? And it's kind of a cool idea too, just because we never get to look at a molecule that's really this size, this big. So let's take this thing and look at kind of how they put it together. Okay, and if you have questions while I'm talking, I've got a couple of different screens up, and so I'm going to be bouncing back and forth looking at some of the things that I've, some notes that I've made and jotted down in order to do this. And I also want to try and check and watch the chat and watch for your comments. So we got all that going on. And let me start off with the idea that what they're going to do here is called a convergent synthesis. So most of the time when we do a synthesis, we do it linearly. We take and we react part A with part B with part C, and we just keep growing the molecule. In a convergent synthesis, what they do is they build half the molecule, and then they build the other half of the molecule, and then they join them together. And what that does is it makes for less steps overall, and it also makes so that you get a higher yield overall out of the chemical reactions because you're not doing as many linear sequential steps. It's just a lot easier to do. So the first thing that they do is they take that L-alanine and they derivatize the L-alanine. And so they've gone through a couple of steps here where in the synthesis that they're showing the hardest of the steps. And so some of the steps have been left out. But they take the L-alanine and they react the L-alanine with the alcohol component. Let's see, I need to make sure that I get this right. I need to turn it around in my brain. And I didn't do it right. There we go. This part, I always try to tell you guys not to ever turn anything around. And so I have my notes that I've made from the synthesis that I was able to find of this molecule. And some of the things are turned around, and so I'm trying to turn them back around in my head. Okay, so there's the L-alanine component. And this is reacting as the hydrochloride salt. And they're reacting this with a derivative of the phosphoric acid that already has the phenol bound to it. And this has chlorines on it. Presumably they started with the trichloride of the phosphorus molecule. And they react this under basic conditions using triethylamine in methylene chloride. So this is ET3N, and that thing is going to serve as a base. They're reacting in CH2Cl2. This is done at room temperature, and they do this for 12 hours. So it's also interesting to see some of these reaction times, because we're used to some pretty short reaction times, and some of these reaction times are longer reaction times, so 12 hours. And what they're able to do is put this together. Let's start by writing phosphorus in here, where they make the nitrogen bond to the phosphorus. And the way that this reaction works is that they deprotonate the amine first off to make the neutral amine. That's what the triethylamine is supposed to do. So the triethylamine acts as a base. So mechanistically, what's going on is we have this guy, which is a non-nucleophilic base. And it's important that we have a non-nucleophilic base, because what we have is a very strong electrophile. When we have these chlorines on here, each one of these chlorines that are on the phosphorus act as leaving groups, but they also serve to do electron withdrawing on the phosphorus, which makes the phosphorus a strong electrophile. And so what happens is the lone pairs pull one of the protons from the alanine derivative. That deprotonates that alanine derivative. And we'll speed this up a little bit by copying and pasting some of these things so that we don't have to draw everything. And so once we deprotonate this guy, now we have the lone pair on there. This becomes the nucleophile. So that nucleophile attacks the phosphorus, binding to the phosphorus. And this mirrors a lot of what we see with not only phosphorus, but a lot of carbonyl chemistry that we see as well. So the lone pair comes in and does a nucleophilic attack. This is your nucleophile attacking the electrophile. The lone pairs lift up, and this goes on. To make the new bond between the two. Oops. So I can get things rolling here. And then that lone pair pushes back down to regenerate the carbonyl, and it kicks out a good leaving group. So this is a loss of leaving group step. And once that leaving group gets kicked out, we're at our final step there. And so the byproducts that are coming out of this, oh, we have a positive charge yet. We got to deal with. That's another part where the triethylamine comes in. And now the triethylamine, they use more than one equivalent of the triethylamine. The triethylamine comes in and deprotonates this. And that takes us to our final step. And so what we've gotten out of this is our first piece. And the triethylamine presumably is precipitating out with a positive charge in the chloride. It's precipitating out as the hydrochloride salt. And so this is crashing out of the methylene chloride and helping to move that reaction forward. And that's a 12-hour reaction where they just all throw it in the pot and let it go. So this piece here, they're calling piece A. And so we've made part A of this molecule. And so this shows a number of different things. It shows this idea of what we also call a sacrificial base or a non-nucleophilic base. And the reason that the base is non-nucleophilic is because of these three ethyl groups that are on it, that there's, when it makes a bond with another molecule, it gets a positive charge on the nitrogen. So if we were to take triethylamine and we were to try to use triethylamine as a nucleophile, number one, it's got a lot of sterics on it. So it doesn't like to be a nucleophile because of the sterics. Number two, when it bonds to something, say if it were to bond to the phosphorus and let's just use R groups on here to make it easier. If it were to bond to the phosphorus, then what happens is there's no way to relieve the positive charge on the nitrogen. And so without any protons on it to be able to pull, there's no way to relieve the positive charge. And so what happens is as these electrons push back in to make the double bond again with the phosphorus, it just kicks that base back out again. And so it's a reversible step. And it's prohibited because of the sterics and also because it can't move forward. And so the base is what's called non-nucleophilic. And so we oftentimes call those a sacrificial base, a base that we're throwing in that can only act as a base and can't act as a nucleophile. So that's part of why triethylamine is used in that way. Another really good base for this is what's called Hunting's base. Hunting's base is a diisopropyl ethylamine, and it's even less nucleophilic than is the triethylamine. But triethylamine's a little bit cheaper, and if you can get away with it and it works, then that's great. But there are many other bases that are like this that do this type of job that are non-nucleophilic, and they're all tertiary amines with a lot of sterics around them. So that's the choice in that one. Okay, the next step is to start working on the sugar component. And so what they do is they take a protected sugar. Let me get this guy out of the way. And this protected sugar looks a little funny when we draw it out because of the way that we abbreviate the protecting groups. But we'll draw one out so that we know what it looks like. So that stereocenter, we've talked about the wiggly bond idea, that stereocenter is both up and down and is racemic at that stereocenter. So that's what the wiggly bond means. And then each one of these hydroxyl groups has a protecting group that has been put on the oxygen to make it unreactive. And these are benzyl ethers. And so we abbreviate them with a BN. And that reaction is actually not a complicated reaction in order to get the benzyl groups on there. But what BN stands for is that this is a benzyl ether. And the benzyl ethers have the oxygen that you see there, and then just an aromatic ring attached through the methyl group. And so this is, when we have something that has the CH2 group here, rather than a phenyl ring, we call this component a benzyl ring. So let's see if I can just highlight this and style it in red, that this is a benzyl group. With the CH2 included as part of the group is the benzyl group. And so this is what's called a benzyl protecting group that we use to protect hydroxyl groups. And they're put on in an SN2 reaction. So actually, it's worthwhile to look at how we actually do that. What we can do is we can take an alcohol. Usually these are primary, secondary alcohols, and we react them with benzyl chloride. And this is also done in the presence of some amine like triethylamine. And the lone pairs on the oxygen act as a nucleophile, and this is inherently an SN2 step. So of the reactions that we were just studying, it's a perfect example of how that reaction is being used in the synthesis of remdesivir. And then we would write that OBN for the benzyl protecting group that's on there. And that's just an SN2 step. So that's where that protected group comes from. We just hit it four different equivalents or three different equivalents of the benzyl protecting group and protect the different oxygen stereocenters. The one that does not get protected doesn't get protected because this is a specific type of group that's right here. It's called a hemiacetal. And that means that the oxygen that is there, that is the hydroxyl group, is tied up in a type of resonance with that carbon, making those lone pairs a little less accessible than the other true hydroxyl groups that are on that molecule. Okay, let's go and look at what reaction we're going to do with this. So let's take this guy. We'll copy it and we'll do the next step. So this reacts with this molecule. See if you recognize this. This is done in an inert atmosphere in nitrogen at room temperature. And this one goes for 48 hours. Okay, so here what they're doing is they're reacting this with acetic anhydride. And we just used acetic anhydride. So they're reacting this with acetic anhydride in DMSO. And this is an oxidation that is a named oxidation. It's called an Albright-Goldman oxidation. And I'm not big on named reactions. I tend to not just memorize the name reactions, but it's very similar to a reaction that we do study that is a common reaction that is always studied within the context of organic chemistry, which is called a Swern reaction or a Swern oxidation. So it's Swern oxidation-like, which I had to look that up because I was trying to figure out what the mechanism of this reaction is, and it's kind of a cool little reaction. Okay, so the way that this reaction works is that we take the alcohol, and I'm going to do it without drawing the entire molecule out. I'm going to kind of break the molecule down a little bit, and we're going to focus on the oxygen that is here, this hydroxyl group, and on the DMSO. So we're going to abbreviate this, and we're going to treat that oxygen as if it's just an alcohol. So here's our alcohol. And the DMSO stands for dimethyl sulfoxide, DMSO. That molecule looks like this. So this is the DMSO. It's a very common solvent to use within organic chemistry. It has a really high boiling point. It's very polar. And I find it a difficult solvent to use because of how difficult it is to remove, but it's very common to see reactions done in DMSO and particularly these types of oxidations. And so what happens here is that if you look at the sulfur and you think about how many electrons the sulfur has on it, it's got 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. It's got 10 electrons. This is the 10 electron exception for the sulfur, which means that it's got more than an octet for the sulfur. And so another way that we can draw this or think about drawing this is a resonance contributor where the sulfur has only 8 electrons. But when it has only 8 electrons, it's in its Zwitter ion form where it's got both a positive and negative charge. So the sulfur actually does, there's a very strong partial minus and partial positive here, and the sulfur really is a strong electrophile. And one of the things that happens is it gets attacked by the oxygen and the lone pairs shift up onto the what was the carbonyl. So we get an O minus and the oxygen bound to it. And then we still have the two methyl groups, and we still have the lone pair and the positive charge on the oxygen there. Presumably, there's also a base in this reaction that they're not telling us. And I don't know what the base is that's in here, but we could imagine that that base is going to be, actually maybe this even makes sense that it's the acetic anhydride that can function as a base and take that proton away, which is actually fairly helpful. Because once we protonate the acetic anhydride, you guys know what happens to the acetic anhydride once it's protonated. It becomes activated for nucleophilic attack. And so now once it's protonated, now I can get nucleophilic attack on the carbonyl, very similar to what we did with the acetylsalicylic acid synthesis. We have the new bond here that is created to the sulfur and our R group that we're working on. And in this case now, what happens is we have another base that winds up pulling one of these protons. So some base in solution pulls a proton, the electrons push in to create a carbonyl. The electrons push up to regenerate this guy. These electrons push in and presumably, let's see, did I push the electrons correctly? I lost something. Actually, it was this bond that I don't like. So I push in to make that. I push onto this. These electrons push in, this guy pushes out. That's the way that we break down. And so what we're doing is we're cleaving and breaking a bond here. We're breaking the bond here. And this whole thing is collapsing. And we are getting, I need to shrink it down so I can see it all at the same time as I draw it. We're getting the R group, which is now got a carbonyl. So that has been oxidized. We have the DMSO, which has been regenerated. We've got the lone pair still in the sulfur. We have an equivalent that has been generated up here of acetic acid. And we also have an acetate that has come off that is presumably part of our base that goes forward. And so this is an oxidation, and this guy has been oxidized. So the product that comes out of this, when we go through and do that oxidation, the product that comes out of this is the oxidized sugar with all these protecting groups still on it. And so that's that product, and that product they call B. So we have the A component and the B component that we have generated. And next they start working on the amine side of the molecule. So let's take the amine side of the molecule and look at what happens there. So in this reaction, we start with this product, which is commercially available. And this is a triazole derivative. And this, they react with number one, a brominating reagent, which is a newer brominating reagent. So they react it with this guy. This is called DBDMH. It's a 1,3-dibromo-5,5-dimethylhydantione molecule. They do this in dimethyl formamide, which is just another solvent. They do it at minus 20 degrees Celsius, and they let it warm up to room temperature. So they start it out at minus 20 and warm it up to room temperature. And then in a second step, they use a reducing agent, presumably to kill the reaction, to stop the reaction. So this is sodium sulfite and water. And then they would do a workup from this. And what this does is it's probably a free radical reaction. And I could not find a mechanism in this one. And the mechanism, on not all of these is not known on all of these steps. And that's something that I wanted to talk about too, is that we don't always know the mechanism of every single chemical reaction. Sometimes we find really useful reactions that that we don't entirely understand why the reaction goes forward. We have some idea of how it works, but we don't always understand entirely how the chemical reaction works. It's one of the things that I love about organic chemistry is that you're never done sort of studying organic chemistry, and that there are always things to be discovered and learned within organic chemistry. And even reactions that have been known for a long time, the mechanism is still under debate for many of those different chemical reactions. And so while I put emphasis on drawing the reaction mechanisms and try to show you the mechanisms as much as I can, sometimes we don't always have a good mechanism to be able to show you. And presumably this reaction is related to some of the reactions that we study. One of the reactions that we use is a brominating reagent that is N-bromosuccinamide. We call it NBS. And you can sort of see the similarity between the two reagents, that if we just focus on the piece of the molecule that is here with the two carbonyls and the nitrogen, that the two carbonyls flanking the nitrogen is very much like this NBS derivative. And these are brominating reagents that generally work by a free radical mechanism. So in order to induce the free radical mechanism, oftentimes what we do is we shine light on this, and these molecules fragment to become free radicals. And so we get a bromine free radical, and we get the nitrogen free radical. And the nitrogen free radical, because it's flanked by the two carbonyls, is extraordinarily stable, which is why this breaks off the way it does. And then that bromine free radical usually abstracts a proton from something else in order to make the reaction go forward. So you generate HBr in the process of doing this, and we generate the carbon radical. The carbon radical then reacts with another NBS molecule, abstracting the bromine, and the reaction continues to go forward. And so this guy abstracts the bromine this way and makes the final product, which is the R group bound to the bromine and another equivalent of the succinamide free radical. So that's how I see this going forward, or envisioning this going forward, is that it's probably a free radical reaction. And that also explains sort of the sodium sulfite and why the sodium sulfite might be in there to stop that reaction from going forward. And the reason that it's so selective for this position rather than the other possible positions where there are hydrogens has to do with the stability of the free radical, and I think they just got lucky in that that's where they wanted it to go. I don't think that, hang on a second, I got to extract a dog out of my office. Whoop. Finley wanted to say hi real quick. There he is, but he's going away.
Sorry.
Thank you. Okay, so so that's that step in the mechanism. And is getting that bromine in place there. And then this next step, what we need to do is we need to put some protecting groups onto this molecule before we can react it. These protons that are sitting over here, these are acidic protons. And they're in the way for our next step. And so we need to put a protecting group onto these and get rid of those protons. And a protecting group is really a molecule that you can put in place, and you can put it in place in a high yield, and you can take it off easily in high yield. So that's the type of protecting group that we're going to put on there. And I'll show you what that step looks like. And then we'll do our next reaction. So from here, what we do, let's copy that molecule and take it with us. So from here, what we do is take and put the protecting group on, and they show this in a single step, essentially. I'm going to break it down into a couple of steps. They use 2.2 equivalents of TMSCL. And they do this in THF at under nitrogen at room temperature. And again, I don't think that they're showing us that there's a base that's also included in this when they do this. TMSCL is trimethyl silochloride. And so what that looks like is three methyl groups and a chloride on this. And essentially, this is just an SN2 reaction again. And what happens here is that the nitrogen that we're looking at, that has the two hydrogens on it, goes in and does an SN2 reaction, knocking out the chloride. This still has one hydrogen on, actually two hydrogens on it, and my R group, and a positive charge. And presumably, we need then some base to come in and deprotonate it. So they would again use a sacrificial base, even though they haven't shown it in the reaction scheme, but there is definitely either Hunting's base or triethylamine or some other base in here that is doing this job that deprotonates this. And what we get out of this is the protected amine that has now not hydrogens on it, but two trimethyl silo groups that are now bound to it. And so when we write this this way. We write it TMS. And those are the protecting groups that are now on the nitrogen. And then in the second step, what we do is we do a halogen, lithium halogen exchange reaction. So that bromine that's there, we react this with four equivalents of N-butyl lithium. We'll look at what that reagent is. This is also done under air sensitive conditions and at minus 78 degrees C. So this is done extremely cold. Minus 78 degrees C is under dry ice and acetone conditions. So the cooling bath that they do is they take dry ice and they pour acetone on top of the dry ice, and that makes a bath which is minus 78 degrees Celsius. And this does a halogen lithium exchange. And so what was the bromine becomes now a lithium. This is a really cool reaction, and the mechanism of this reaction is not well understood at all. But what it does is it changes the molecule fundamentally in its properties, and it's called an umpalong. And it's one of the coolest words in chemistry, an umpalong. An umpalong is where you change from electrophile to nucleophile or nucleophile to electrophile. You completely reverse the polarity of the molecule is what an umpalong is. And so let's take a look at this. First off, let's understand this reagent, N-butyl lithium. N-butyl lithium, so this is butane. And N-butyl lithium is where I have taken and put an anion onto this, and the cation is the lithium. This is N-butyl lithium. And it is an extremely strong base. So when you look at the pKa of the proton that we have pulled off, the pKa of that proton is about 60. That means that the base that we have here, remember that when you look at a weak acid, the conjugate of a weak acid is a strong base. But we've never seen a weak acid with a pKa of 60 to understand how strong that base actually is that is generated from that. So N-butyl lithium, if it hits air or any sort of moisture, immediately starts to smoke and can catch fire from the amount of heat that's generated when it sucks a proton or pulls a proton from a water molecule. If you shoot it into water, it spontaneously combusts. It's not the strongest of the bases that we use, but it's the strongest of the bases that I generally let you use within the context of the organic chemistry class within special projects. We've used N-butyl lithium quite a bit within special projects. And it needs to be handled under inert atmospheres, under nitrogen in glass syringes. And you can't have any air in the reaction. We need to be very careful of having air present in the reaction. And essentially what we're doing is we're taking that that reagent that had the bromine. And when we think about the polarity of this bond is such that the bromine is partial minus and the carbon is partial positive. When we go through and do this chemical reaction, and we do it with the N-butyl lithium, we generate or exchange, we exchange the bromine for the lithium. And like I said, in a reaction that's not well understood, so we don't have the reaction mechanism for this, but presumably, and we're drawing a bond here, but it's not really so much a bond. It's really that we have a cation and an anion. And so this anion is a carbanion. And it's changed it into a nucleophilic form of carbon. And so what we had over here was an electrophile with its partial positive, and we've turned it into a nucleophile. And that is the Umpelung reaction, or an Umpelung, a demonstration of changing from an electrophile to a nucleophile going through a chemical reaction. Okay, so this piece that they have here, this piece they're calling part C. So far what we've been doing is a number of different steps getting each of the parts together. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take some of those parts and start reacting some of those parts together to start to build the overall molecule. So the rest of it, let's go down to a new page. What we do is we take that sugar molecule that we had oxidized and we react the sugar molecule with the nitrogen, with the carbanion that we just made. And they take this and they react this with this guy. So this has the lithium on it. And this presumably is the anion, which is now going to do a nucleophilic attack on the carbon of the carbonyl, opening up that carbonyl. And they do this step under nitrogen. Again, so they get all the air out of the reaction and it's done under nitrogen at minus 78 degrees Celsius. And then that is the first step. So that is the first thing that they do. And then number two, they have an acidic workup that they do. And the acidic workup generally means that they are hitting this with some sort of aqueous acid, a weak aqueous acid, to protonate the products that are coming out of this. So when they say acidic workup, we just think source of protons. So this is just giving us some proton sources that are here. Okay, and out of this comes the molecule where we have bound the two together. So we've made the adduct. Let's see if I am capable of drawing this. TMS, and everything is there. The sources of protons were to protonate that hydroxyl group, and then I still have each of these benzyl groups and the benzyl group on this piece. So what's really cool to see about this is that all of these groups are still protecting groups. Let's do protecting groups in green. So we have the TMS protecting groups, the benzyl protecting groups, that this molecule has all these different protecting groups that are still on it. And if you're looking closely at it too, what we've created is a stereocenter that's right there. But the stereocenter isn't defined. The stereocenter, because it was flat, had the ability of the nucleophile to attack from above and below that carbonyl, which means that this bond, as I've drawn as a straight bond, is really not a straight bond, but a wiggly bond, in that I have a one-to-one mixture of diastereomers. And so this is one-to-one mixture of diastereomers. And those diastereomers need to be separated before we can really move on. And so they're gonna do that at a later step, but let's go through and show what the next reaction is that they do here. How's everybody doing so far? So I know that this is super complicated in terms of, we've never seen any reactions like this, and that it's a whole lot of chemistry that we haven't studied. But one of the things that's really cool to see for me is that we spend so much time focusing on single reactions and the ability to be able to take and look at an overall synthesis of a really complicated molecule and break it down into how many steps it's going to take to actually make this molecule. And the fact that they're going to try to do this on a big enough scale industrially to supply not just the United States, but to supply the world with this product in order to help people is astounding in how difficult this actually is a task to actually do. And that when we try to design a synthesis like this, we try to design it in the most efficient way that we can with the least number of steps, with the highest possible yield. And remember that your yields, I guess we never actually really got to look at the acetylsalicylic acid yield, but the acetylsalicylic acid yield, which is one step, oftentimes goes somewhere between 60 on up to maybe 70, 80% is a general yield for you guys. And that when you look at the overall yield of a synthesis, it's the yield of the first step times the yield of the second step times the yield of the third step times the yield of the fourth step. The yields combine, they multiply. And so if you have a yield that is a 30% yield or a 40% yield, that's 0.4 times the overall yield. And each one of those yields, depending upon how big or how low it is, multiplies together such that overall for the entire synthesis, you may be looking at maybe a 5% yield overall for the entire synthesis by the time you get to it. Hopefully that's not true for these industrial processes. Hopefully they've got these worked out so that these are all in the 90%. But even though, let's say that they were all in the 90% yields and you had 7-8 steps, that's 0.9 to the 7th or 8th power because you're multiplying them times each other. That's still a pretty low yield by the time you get down to the bottom of it, even at 90% for each one of those yields. So anyway, that's what, how's the preferred stereo orientation selected for? Colin, we're gonna get to that in a minute and I'm gonna show you how we do that. We're gonna do a couple more reactions and then we'll get to the point where we actually talk about how do they start separating these, because it needs to be sold as a single isomer, cannot be sold as a racemate, definitely cannot be sold as a mixture of one-to-one diastereomers. So yeah, we'll get to that in a second. Okay, so let's take this molecule now and look at the next step that we're going to do. We'll take a protecting group and all. And yeah, let's do it out linear. So we take this protected, now substituted sugar, And what we're going to do is two reactions, three reactions actually. Number one, we use 3.5 equivalents of a reagent called TMSCN. This is done in nitrogen. DCM is dichloromethane, so I'm not going to write it DCM. I'm going to write it CH2Cl2. And they do this at minus 78 degrees. Again, really cold for 10 minutes. And then presumably they move directly to the next step without isolating. So these reactions are done on top of each other. They add in 4.5 equivalents of a reagent called TMSOTF. And this is done under the same inert conditions, CH2Cl2, minus 78 degrees, 1 hour. And then they treat this with a base, sodium hydrogen carbonate aqueous. And so this is a basic workup, essentially. And what they do here is they replace the hydroxyl group with the cyano group. And so we need to look at a couple of these reagents and see how they've actually done that. But that was the entire point of all of those reagents, was to replace the hydroxyl group with the cyano group. And so let's look at a couple of the reagents and see what these reagents look like. TMSCN is the trimethyl silyl that has the cyano group on it. And the TMSOTF, this is called a triflate, and this has the TMS group on it. And a triflate, which is a CF3 group. No, wait, that's not the triflate. Triflate has the CF3 group here. So instead of a tosylate or mesylate, that's the triflate. And essentially what these molecules are doing is the TMS group is a protecting group, but it also allows this to function as the silicon. Silicon is very oxophilic. Silicon loves oxygen, and the oxygen-silicon bond is a fairly strong bond. And so presumably what's taking place here is that our molecule that has the oxygen on it is first off displacing the cyano group. So if we take a look at our hydroxyl group and the first step, which had the cyano group present, that this is presumably an SN2 step where the oxygen is binding to the silicon and becoming a good leaving group that's here. And we have kicked out, so we still have a proton that is here. This is positively charged. We have the cyano group that has been kicked out. So the cyano group is now in solution and is hanging around in solution. Some base presumably comes and takes that. I'm guessing that it is not the cyano group because that would make hydrogen cyanide, and hydrogen cyanide is a gas and would leave. So there must be some other base that is in solution here that takes that. And then in the next step with the TMSOTF, this is the part that I don't entirely understand where the TMSOTF is doing. And I hadn't really thought that piece through, but presumably what's happening is the cyanide is coming back and doing a secondary SN2 and kicking out what has become a good leaving group. And it may be that that this piece here, this is one of the best leaving groups that we've got. This is the OTF part. And this is just a super good leaving group. That generally what we do is that when we want to do an SN2 reaction and we want to have a really good leaving group, and alcohols are poor leaving groups, we usually use these triflates and tosylates, these things that have this type of structure, to convert. It's usually a way of taking an OH group and converting it into an OTF, which is a poor leaving group for the hydroxide, and then turning it into a super good leaving group. And we usually do this with with a TMSCl, where we have a chloride leaving group. It's usually an SN2 reaction that does this conversion, that puts this group on here and turns it into a super good leaving group. In this reaction, I assume that they're doing something very similar to that. But essentially what has to happen is the cyano group then has to come in and do an SN2 reaction to kick this guy out, to kick out the leaving group that is presumably making the RCN. And so I need to think through the steps that are there, but essentially what they've done is they've done a series of SN2 reactions. In order to get that cyano group in there. However, the cyano group is still in a mixture of anomers or diastereomers. So this is a one-to-one mixture of diastereomers. And so we need to separate out those diastereomers, but they don't do that yet. Before they separate out the diastereomers, they're going to remove all the different protecting groups. And so to remove those protecting groups, what they do is they take the molecule. Where did I draw it? Let's grab it from here. And we're going to do a protecting group removal. They use BCl3, boron trichloride, in methylene chloride, CH2Cl2. They do this at minus 20 degrees C. And then they go through and they hit this with methanol and a base, potassium carbonate. And then they go through and they do reverse phase HPLC. Okay. This step here is again an SN2 step. You can think of the BCl3 as being a source of Cl minus nucleophile. And the benzyl protecting groups the benzyl position is an excellent SN2 electrophile. It has really low sterics around it, and the chloride ion comes in and does an SN2 reaction where it kicks out this guy as a good leaving group and makes the chloride substrate that comes out that way. So it's a deprotection for all of the benzene groups. So we take out all of the benzyl groups. And in the next step, the methanol and the potassium carbonate removes the trimethyl silyl groups that are in there as well. And so we deprotect the entire molecule. And what we get that comes out of this is all of these are now deprotected. So we get the NH2 back. The cyano group is still in there. These benzyl groups are now gone. These are all hydroxyl groups. We have deprotected the entire molecule. And after deprotection, the reverse phase HPLC, what they have done is they have separated out using reverse phase, just like we talked about for the, we just did reverse phase. Oh, I'm losing it. Oh, it was for the caffeine. So we just did reverse phase column chromatography for the caffeine, and we looked at how that reverse phase actually worked, where it was the C18 impregnated silica gel and how it made more polar things come out fast and retained less polar items. This is very similar to that, only this is HPLC. And because these were diastereomers, this was one-to-one diastereomers. Diastereomers are different than enantiomers. Diastereomers can be separated by chromatography. So we can use column chromatography, thin layer chromatography, HPLC, high performance liquid chromatography. All this is, HPLC is a column, like we would do column chromatography, but they put it inside a metal column rather than a glass column. They attach a great big pump to it, and they push materials through at very, very high pressures. So it's hugely pressurized. And then there's a detector on the other side of it that allows you to know when different compounds are coming through, and you simply change fractions to know when that, as soon as you see that new compound coming through. And so they're separating these out based on the based on their polarity differences. And so what we get out of this is now a single isomer. They have separated it out, and we have just the single isomer, which means that this step is only a 50% yield, because you had to throw away 50% of it because it was the wrong isomer. So the best that you can get at this point is a 50% yield at this piece, at this step. So, and the rest of it has to be thrown away. So that's an important sort of aspect to that part of the chemical reaction. Okay, so once we've done that, now what we do is we take the two main components that we've put together. So we've put together two halves of the molecule, essentially. We have this half of the molecule that we just made. So we're going to bring that down. And we're going to react that with the other half of the molecule that we made, which contains the phosphorus component. I've got to go all the way back up to find it. This piece. And we're going to react these two pieces together. And essentially what's happening here is that this oxygen that is primary and the phosphorus, which has the leaving group on it, are what are being reacted together. And it's reacting with that oxygen because it's a primary oxygen as compared to these guys, which are each secondary. So it's outcompeting the primary oxygen, which is a better nucleophile, is outcompeting the second oxygens and outcompeting the nitrogen up here, which is an aniline derivative. Is there a question? Or Katrina's microphone got unmuted there on accident. Okay. So So we're reacting these two groups together. And as these two groups come together, essentially what's happening is, let me draw the mechanism in a shorter sort of framework. We're taking ROH and reacting it with the phosphorus, which has the chlorine leaving group. And there are two other R groups that are also on this phosphorus. We just have the lone pairs coming in, reacting at the carbonyl. The leaving group is there. We now have the O minus. This has a positive charge on it. The electrons push back in, push out the leaving group. We regenerate the carbonyl. We have each of the R groups still attached. We make the new bond. And then the chloride or some other base removes the proton in order to take us to the final product. And so we're getting HCl as a byproduct, and presumably they're using a sacrificial base in order to do this reaction as well. So we're taking these two groups together. We'll just write this out in one reaction. And I don't see where, oh, that's right. So they use a couple of reagents to accomplish this. They use a solvent, which I'm not sure what the name of this solvent is, but it's a phosphoric acid solvent, and they use a base, which is an imidazole-like base. So this is an amine base that is a sacrificial base, and they put this molecule together. I guess I got to draw out the whole thing now. So let's start from here. And this is going to come out as a mixture of diastereomers. Again, so we have a second mixture of diastereomers that then needs to be resolved. And it's here that we have a one-to-one mixture of diastereomers. And so from this point, what they do is what's called a chiral resolution. And you remember that when we did the SN2, not, was it the SN2? No, where did we do it? We talked about chiral resolutions. We did it in the stereochemical chapter, where we talked about reacting with something like tartaric acid in order to make diastereomeric or diastereomeric salts. This is a mixture of diastereomers, not enantiomers. So this is a little bit easier to separate. But again, they do some sort of chiral resolution to separate this out. And again, they're getting a 50% yield because they have to throw away 50% of this, which is not the right molecule. So they get a second 50% yield here. And at this point is where they get, but did I not finish out the bottom of that molecule? I did not. I was missing that piece. And this piece becomes the forward one. And that molecule is remdesivir. Remdesivir. And so this is, they're getting a 50% yield on that last step as well. And that's the whole synthesis of that thing. So what I've got is the way that we would normally draw this out. Let me grab these two pages. And I'll tag that onto the bottom of this because it's a much easier way to sort of look at it. Just so that those are in the notes as well. Okay, let's see if I've got everything there. I think I do now. I think I need to cut out one more page. Okay, so when they do the synthesis, they tend to draw them all out stepwise. And so these are the notes that I had made sort of before going through this that I was following through with that doesn't have all the mechanistic detail in them, but has each of the individual steps written out in sort of a more linear sort of fashion. And also what I've got on there is all of the stereocenters mapped out so that you can see what all the stereocenters are. Which is kind of cool too. Anyway, that's the synthesis of the molecule that they're doing. And it's just astounding how they have to throw away 50% of that molecule each time in order to deal with the diastereomer issues that they have. And that's sort of why they do it in a convergent synthesis, because if you realize what they're doing, is that at the step that is here, where they get a 50% yield, so there's a 50% yield at this step where they go through and they do the reverse phase HPLC, that's only on that one part before they bring the parts together. So that presumably the other chemical reactions had a much higher yield, and they're not throwing away 50% of the molecule. It's only in that one step that they get that 50%. And then here, where they bring these two together and they do the resolution, that they get a 50% yield down at this part as well. And then I don't know what the other yields are on the other chemical reactions, but I can imagine that they're only making this thing in somewhere that is under 10% for the overall synthesis. So everything that they're putting into it and all the work that they're doing, they're probably getting less than a 10% yield on the overall molecule and scaling that up into an industrial process. And it's also difficult that when you look at this and you think about how they're going to do this, some of these reactions are very easy to do on small scale, but anytime you have a reaction that is like this, that has a minus 78 degree temperature in it, that is extremely difficult to do on an industrial scale, to keep everything at minus 78 degrees C and to synthesize these. It just costs a ton of money to be able to go through and do these types of reactions at these types of temperatures. The other thing that's really hard, besides doing them at very low temperatures, is to do things at very high temperatures. So if you're doing things that are at 110, 150 degrees C, those are incredibly expensive. And so you look at trying to make a reaction that is what is called commercially viable. Commercially viable reactions are an example of a commercially viable reaction is what we had up at the top. So this reaction, this first reaction where it's room temperature, 12 hours, or room temperature, 48 hours. Those are extremely commercially viable because all you do is you throw in all the reactants and you just let them stir for a day or two, and they're stirring at room temperature. So you're not putting any energy in, or you're not expending a tremendous amount of energy to make that product. And so that becomes more commercially viable. And that's what we try to do, is we try to find things that make it more commercially viable. So actually what I should do is these steps here, these are great steps because they're commercially viable. Steps that are not so great are highlighted in red. And then these steps where we're actually resolving the animers, these steps are horrible because here you're only getting 50% yields. And so these resolutions, those resolutions are really horrible steps. And so we've got a couple of nice commercially viable steps combined with some really crappy ones in order to make this product. Francisco, how is the organic waste like this disposed of safely? Organic waste like this is disposed of through combustion. And if it can't be recycled, if there's not a way to go through and to reuse some of these products, then what they typically do is they typically take the waste and combust the waste. And they do it in a very, they do it in a way in which the product is completely combusted. And so those processing plants that destroy waste like this have a number of different filters and things on the back end of them to try to capture different toxic components that are coming out, but they try to combust them entirely so that you're breaking it down into carbon dioxide, water, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides. You're breaking them all down into their oxides. And then the metal salts, presumably, that are part of that are either recycled or destroyed in some other way. I'm not exactly sure how they do that entirely, but that's a great question. When you have so much waste that's coming out of this, how do you deal with all that chemical waste in a safe manner and dispose of it safely? And it's mainly through combustion process. So I'm sure this leads to a lot more questions than it does answers, but it's nice to see how a medication is actually made. And one of the things that I didn't talk about, but some of these chemical reactions, there are other ways to do things rather than these resolutions where they take the diastereomers and resolve them. Another way to do these types of reactions is what's called stereoselectively, where we look to see, can we do this chemical reaction? For instance, can we take the step above this step and do it in a stereoselective manner? So here what we ended up with was one-to-one anomers. Is there a way to take this and to do it this way? And I don't know what the reagents would be that would do this, but this is what we, oh, there it goes, okay. Actually, it's probably easier if I just circle everything to delete it. And so we'll put a big question mark here. How do we do this in a single step so that we don't get anomers, but what we get is the thing that we want? And we get it in a yield. This is what is called stereoselective synthesis. And I guarantee you, as they're scaling this up and looking at different ways to make this, they're trying to figure out how they can do that stereoselectively so that they don't actually have to throw away 50% of the material, so that they can make it all in one isomer and not have to throw away the 50%. Stereoselective synthesis is a big area of organic chemistry, and looking at making different reactions stereoselective. How do we add a cyano group in a stereoselective manner like that? Those are really cool types of reactions. And that was a big focus of my graduate studies and my graduate research group, was methodologies for stereoselective synthesis for many different types of chemical reactions. So that's sort of a cool idea there too. How do we do that in a single step? All right, that was the synthesis that I wanted to present today, and just take some time and just look at it and see sort of what that molecule looks like, how they're planning on putting it together, what that synthesis looks like, and give you an idea for what organic chemistry looks like for much larger molecules rather than single steps, how do we build an entire molecule? And in second semester, we wouldn't be able to do anything like this because it's way too long a synthesis. Usually what we do is we do a synthesis that has a maximum of 3 or 4 steps. And if it were a molecule like this that we were thinking about, that somebody was really interested in putting together, what we would do is maybe the first 3 steps in the synthesis towards this molecule. And so we would buy the reagents that would be allowing us to be able to do just these first 3 steps, maybe taking the L-alanine and mixing it together with the phosphorus in order to get that, or focusing on the sugar reaction. This is a great reaction, is protecting the sugar with the benzyl groups and then doing the acetic anhydride step in order to, so we would take and put the benzyl protecting groups on the sugar molecule, because I don't think you can buy this benzyl protected. And then we would take and react this with acetic anhydride and make that part. And those would be the steps that we would look at in doing in special projects, is trying to reproduce just those components. Because in the 6 weeks that we have, or 7 weeks that we have for special projects, you have a limited amount of time. And even though you're reproducing work, every time you try to do a reaction, it doesn't turn out the exact way that you would think. When you're following Pavia, the reactions in Pavia work every single time, and you can get really high yields with them. When you're following something from the literature, it takes us a little while to figure out how to do those chemical reactions and how to do it with the equipment that we've got and to get the yield up enough to be able to move on to the second step. And so oftentimes we'll spend a week or two just trying to nail down one reaction before we even move to the second reaction. And then when we move to the second reaction, we spend a week or two trying to nail down that one. We've already gone through 4 weeks to move to the third reaction. Sometimes we need to go back to the first reaction and make more, because we've wasted all of the starting material that we had just trying to figure out the second reaction. So we go back and we do the first one again, then we do the second one, we've made enough. Now we're into the third, but we're into our last week, and we may or may not get that third reaction actually done. And that's how the special projects tend to go, is a lot of back and forth and learning and trying to move the steps forward within the time frame that we've got, which turns out to be very difficult, but exciting in that we're working on things that we're constantly learning and revising our procedure and trying to follow what the literature says to do. So anyway, that's some overviews of remdesivir and a little bit about special projects and how complicated synthesis can be. And when we get through the second semester material, we will have covered the majority of these reactions. And looking back at this second semester even becomes a little bit more interesting, in that you can see how much organic chemistry we've covered. Even just in this, the number of SN2 reactions that are in this are pretty cool. There was at least 4 or 5 different SN2 reactions that are within just this synthesis itself. So let's do a couple of things here. Let's open it up to any sort of questions that you've got. Although it was always open to questions, but if you've got more, go ahead and fire them away. And if not, let's open it up for anything that you want to do in lecture. And I'll just stay on the line and we can do some, we could treat it like office hours for any of the stuff that you guys want to deal with. And if nobody wants to do that, then I'm happy also calling it good and giving us a break until we get to lecture at 11:10. So any and all of the above. At this point, you're welcome to check out. You're welcome to stay on the line. You're welcome to grill me about any of these reactions or anything for office hours. You're welcome, Cole.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Caden.
Hey, Jason, quick question. So I forgot the name of the drug you just made. I didn't write it down. But
remdesivir.
Yes, remdesivir. How do they come up with that structure?
You know, that's a great question. And I have no idea. Remdesivir was in the pipeline. It is a new drug that had not gone through FDA approval, but it was a drug that was being developed by, I can't remember the name of the company. I have to look back up the name of the company. But they must have had this as a target for something. I mean, they it was an antiviral of some type. And so they had targeted one of the viral processes. And let me see if I see it real quick. Because that's a great question. And I don't know what its mode of action is, but its mode of action will tell us. So it says that it acts against esterases and phosphoroamidases. It's an adenosine nucleotide triphosphate analog, and it interferes with the action of viral RNA-dependent RNA polymerases. And so it's inhibiting the ability of the virus to use RNA polymerases in order to rebuild the viral RNA. It's prohibiting production of the viral RNA. And therefore prohibiting the virus from injecting that RNA into the cells and to continue moving. And so basically what it's doing is that whatever that viral RNA polymerase is, this thing is in some way binding to it and locking it up and preventing it from moving. So the active metabolite is actually this piece. If you can still see my screen, the active metabolite is this piece here. And so what's happening is that thing is binding to the RNA polymerase in place of the normal sugar and nucleotide that are supposed to be on there, and this prevents it from working. So basically what they did is they targeted this to be uptaken by that polymerase and to block it, basically.
So if, I mean, this might sound like a dumb question, but if that's the only active piece, why do you need the rest of that structure?
Because presumably in the synthesis of the polymerase is a molecule that the body is putting together or that the virus is coded to put together. And it's specific for the viral RNA, so it doesn't inhibit other RNA processes within the human body. And so the rest of that molecule is delivery. It is that in the synthesis of the polymerase itself, it is seeing that as the normal sugar component that it is supposed to grab. And the rest of that molecule is just there for delivery purposes in order to have it uptaken the way that it's supposed to be.
Awesome. Cool.
Well, I can't explain it better than that. That's the best I can. That's the best I've got for you.
That made sense.
Okay.
Cool. Well, thank you, Jason. Have a good one.
You're welcome.
Jason, I had a question about the formal report that's due.
Okay.
So I know we have to do the discussion part, but I was just wondering if it's just the reaction mechanism that we have to do?
Yes, just the reaction mechanism. That's all I wanted you to do.
Oh, okay. Okay, sounds good.
Okay?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jason?
Hey, Colin.
So, do you have any idea why that this wouldn't affect like human RNA synthesis?
I think that the RNA, the viral RNA, has its own polymerase. And I think that what we're targeting is the viral RNA polymerase rather than any sort of human polymerases that are in there. So we have our own set of DNA polymerases and RNA polymerases, and there's all of these components that work within our bodies. The viral RNA polymerase must be specific to the virus in some way, and that's what they're targeting.
Okay. That's pretty cool. I wonder.
Yeah. If it was. Hey, did you get the email that I sent you?
Yeah, I did, and it was really helpful.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
I still could only, although I'm still only three isomers in, though. Like, I'm not sure what the fourth option is. Because, so, do you mind if we talk about this now?
Yeah, it's fine.
So, two of the hydride shifts are from two of the hydride shifts would have the same result, which is not more stable than...
Correct.
Okay. Because it's still like a secondary cation.
Correct. So if we take those two out, let me copy this guy. And if we take those two out, which are the two that are on the ends over here, so those two are out.
Yeah.
Then we've got four other bonds that are highlighted. Those four other bonds that are highlighted presumably then lead to the four other isomers that could result.
Okay. I get that, but if we did the alkyl shift with the one on the left, wouldn't that result with like a primary carbocation?
Oh, I see it. Okay. No, I see the reason that you're not finding the one. Okay. Yes, let's take this one out. It does result in a primary. You're right. So that takes us down to three. And then you go, okay, well, what do I do with those three? How do I get one more out of those three? Presumably.
Right shift, like, or I don't know. Sorry.
It's okay. What were you going to ask?
Well, I was wondering if each isomer results from exactly one shift, or if you can do like an alkyl shift and a hydride shift on that.
Not exactly, but we can do a different type of shift. So let me get rid of these two. And then there's another type of shift that can occur that we hadn't really thought about. So in one essence, what I can do is, and this is probably one that you've already done, is that you can do the alkyl shift where I break the bond here and reconnect it at that position. So reconnecting, yeah. And you found that one, right?
Yes.
Okay. Let's imagine then that what I do is I break it on this side and reconnect it this way.
Oh.
What happens... Go ahead.
Ring.
What's that?
So that it's a single ring with.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, cool. With the methyl group. I wouldn't have thought of that.
So right, and so what happens there is you have the six-membered ring system that was there. Now you have that four-membered ring system, the double bond there, the double bond there, and the positive charge is there, and while it is secondary, look at the amount of resonance that gets created in that these double bonds can all shift. And So you have a huge resonance system now. So it's secondary, really what we would call secondary allylic, meaning that it has resonance. And so the resonance is the key step there. And it's not like a hydride shift or an alkyl shift in the way that we were thinking about before, but it is sort of a migration of a bond. It's a bond migration that leads to greater stabilization through resonance.
Interesting.
And you're right. It would have been really hard to find, which is why I gave such a long time for this one and was encouraging everybody to work together, because usually once somebody finds it or proposes it, then it all sort of filters around and everybody learns from it.
Wow. That's really cool.
So you were exactly right. And so you shouldn't feel frustrated at all in not being able to see that. It is it is a random chance that people tend to find it, not that they were super smart and just saw it. It just comes from playing with it and looking for ways to move the bonds around to make things more stable.
That's fun. I'm glad I kept asking.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I encourage you to continue asking. You're asking all the right questions and you're doing a great job.
Thanks, Jason.
Okay.
Yeah.
So spread that around. If people are still having trouble or you hear anybody's having trouble, feel free to give me the answer and explain it.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Cool. See you in lecture.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.